2925 and Senate file. Wait a second, what's the Senate file?
It's just a girl under your House file.
Oh, okay, it's House file. It's called the Word. And so if we could, Ms. Pontius has been gracious enough to offer to do a side-by-side. And if we can begin with that, just so folks know, the intention, the primary intention, at least my desire was when we passed the different languages, to have a conference committee discussion and entertain testimony on the preponderance of the evidence standard or clear and convincing standard. That is my main focus here, with my desire in order to pass a different language. But we are going to do a side-by-side walkthrough just so everyone knows what they're talking about. I would add the caveat that despite the fact that on the House floor, the amendment that I offered in my language, and as well as the amendment that I talked about the entire time on the floor, was the clear and convincing standard. The amendment, that number that the clerk took up was preponderance standard. So technically that is in the House language, but as far as I'm concerned, the House position, at least at this point, is clear and convincing. But my statement on the House floor with the reason for that was that I wanted to have the discussion in conference to flesh out the reasons for it. So we remain flexible now with that. Anything you wanted to begin with, Senator Latz?
Nope.
Okay, Ms. Pontius.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and members, there's two documents we're working from. We got the side-by-side or the text of the two bills, and there's kind of a summary side-by-side. And in the middle column of that, I kind of highlighted the main differences between the two. And they actually track fairly closely in terms of structure. In Section 1, the definition of exonerated is similar. There are some differences. If you look at the House language, it refers to having a judgment vacated or new trial granted on grounds consistent with innocence. That language is not in the Senate bill. The Senate bill requires that have taken place for all convictions arising out of the same behavioral incident. That's not in the House bill. And then under Subdivision 2, the procedures are similar. The House refers to the petition being brought in the court where the original conviction was obtained, whereas the Senate requires it before the court where the exoneration order was obtained, which in most cases will probably end up getting into the same place, but there is a difference there in the language. And then the House requires the prosecutor to respond to the petition within 60 days, whereas the Senate requires it in 20 days. Both bills require that a petition be brought within 2 years after exoneration, but then the Senate does allow a later petition if the petitioner establishes it's not frivolous and in the interest of justice. And it also includes special language dealing with persons who were released on grounds consistent with exoneration before the effective date. They would have 2 years from the effective date to bring an action. That issue is not addressed in the House language. And then in what's House Subdivision 3 is basically parallel to Senate Subdivisions 3 and 4, and basically have two sort of categories for being eligible for exoneration. The House kind of combines compensation based on innocence and compensation without establishing innocence into one category of based on in the interest of justice. So if you look at the House paragraph A lines up more closely with Senate Subdivision 4, and this deals with cases where the prosecutor joins in the petition and indicates the original complaint likely would not have been filed or would have dismissed. Probably one substantive difference between the language, if you go to the top of the second page of the side-by-side summary, the House refers to the prosecutor making that decision with knowledge of all circumstances, where the Senate language is tied to newly discovered evidence. And then the House also includes additional language that if the prosecutor does join in the petition and agree to compensation, that it conclusively establishes eligibility and the court must issue an order accordingly. And then the House paragraph B and Senate Subdivision 3 are nearly identical. The House does include language that requires the court to go ahead and determine eligibility based on that, the new provisions there, if the prosecutor hasn't joined in the petition. And then next, if you jump up, now we're working off of R2 on the side-by-side of the language. Subdivision 4, evidence. The language is similar. There are a few differences, like if you look at the top of the page on both sides, the house refers to a written statement filed with the court, where the Senate refers to a written affidavit, and the house refers to oral versus verbal statement on the record. There's some other just minor differences in the language. And then, let's see, the House also has language that allows the court to consider other offenses that may have been committed by the petitioner in the same behavioral incident. And then there's also some victims' rights provisions that are included in the House language, but not the Senate language. And then the elements are identical except just for a technical cross-reference. And then on the bottom of R2, the Senate has hearing language that is not in the House bill. And then flipping over to R3, the order, they're nearly identical. The House has language referring to the court considering all the files and records. And then for the appeal language, they're also similar. The House prevents the petitioner from appealing an order that grants eligibility, and it doesn't include the Senate language specifying that service of the notice of appeal has to be made on the Attorney General. That's because the cross-reference to the statute 590.06 under the general post-conviction relief law requires service on the Attorney General. So by referring to that, it implies that that would have to be done. So that's why the Senate put that additional clause in there. And then Section 2 is identical on both sides until you get to Subdivision 2. That's identical on both sides. That's the expungement amendment. And just as a sort of a note right now, you know, the expungement bill conference committee report is out, so at some point we need to figure out how to meld this language into that language. And Section 3, the claim is the basic claim for compensation language. Subdivision 1 is identical in both bills. And Subdivision 2, dealing with the respondent filing requirement, there's additional House language regarding who represents the state that's not in the Senate bill. The House states it's either the Attorney General or the legal counsel for the Department of Management and Budget. And then Subdivision 3, agent for claimant, is identical. Subdivision, and now we're on the text, are up on R4 now. Statute of limitations is different in the two bills. The House requires that a claim be brought for compensation be brought within 60 days after the order was issued, finding that the person is eligible for compensation. The Senate is 2 years. And then the Senate also includes language addressing persons who have been released from custody on grounds consistent with an exoneration before the effective date and gives them 2 years to bring a claim. Section 4, the compensation panels, identical. Section 5, pre-hearing settlements, is identical. Now we're over on R5 of the language. And Section 6, Subdivision 1, is identical. Subdivision 2, the only difference is that the House refers to a registered predatory offender versus the Senate refers to a registered sex offender, and I believe the correct term is predatory, not sex offender. And then on the last page of the summary of the side-by-side, under Clause 2 there, let's see, the House refers to reimbursement for medical and dental expenses incurred as a result of imprisonment, whereas the Senate refers to those expenses related to imprisonment. And under clause 5, the House has additional language specifying that there's no reimbursement for child support payments already owed before incarceration. And finally, going to R6, on the side-by-side, again, we've got the registered predatory versus registered sex offender. And then if you go down, then Senate section or subdivision 8, child support payments, there's no comparable provision in the House bill.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Good.
Are we on R6 now?
Yes, Planius. On the side-by-side, yes. And then from there on, I think the bills are identical.
Good. Thank you. Questions from members? I see no questions from members for the walkthrough of the side-by-side. Thank you for that, Ms. Planius. At this point, the conference committee would like to hear from members or from members of the audience who wish to be heard on the differences in the bills. And I know there are several members, although we do not have a list. So if you could just come forward and introduce yourself for the record as to your position on the differences in the language. Mr. Choi, thank you for coming. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the conference committee. My name is John Choi, and I am the Ramsey County Attorney. And before I begin, I first of all just want to acknowledge and thank you, Representative Lesh, and you, Senator Latz, as the chief authors of this bill. Both of you have, I think, just been very fair in this process, and so I just wanted to acknowledge I personally appreciate your openness to listening to some of these issues, because I think we can all agree on having some form or some procedure in which we recognize situations that are before us and we figure out a way to make people whole because of things that have happened as a result of the criminal justice system. And so we can agree on that, but then when we get into the details, it's rather complex, and I just very much appreciate the approach that both of you have taken to listen to all of the issues. And so here we are, and I also want to acknowledge and thank the Innocence Project for their work on this bill, and also the work that they have done with us, because I think we have come a long way with respect to the conversations. And ultimately where the Association of County Attorneys are on this bill. We never really opposed the concept of having a process in place, but the details, and as the bill was introduced, there was a lot of consternation about it, but a lot of things have dramatically improved, and we want to thank you, but also the Innocence Project, for working with us on that. I mean, one thing just to start out with is the concept or the terminology of wrongful conviction. You're not going to see those two words here anywhere in the bill because oftentimes when we have to make these really tough decisions, charging decisions, trying cases and having juries make those decisions, they're not done in bad faith. They're done in good faith. But there are times, and I think this is where we have come a long way, is to recognize that even despite all of those good intentions, there can be situations in which somebody could have been incarcerated, but for the fact that evidence or information was not available when we had charged that case, and now it is today. And so I think what we have done, at least in terms of how this bill has progressed, and I do believe that the House language, and I believe that the Innocence Project would agree, that the House language would reflect all of those conversations that we've had, and we've come to some sort of, agreement on the language, except for this one issue, and it's a very important one, which is the burden of proof in which a petitioner would need to establish innocence. And the reason why it's important is because one of the reasons why the county attorneys had a lot of heartburn over this issue is because of this whole concept of statutorily putting into place a definition of exoneration that included this particular specific concept in which there would be post-conviction court that would order a new trial, or a court of appeals that would order a remand and ask for a new trial. But then if the prosecutor did not proceed with retrying that case, that would be considered an exoneration. And I know from working with the Innocence Project, I understand why they are such strong advocates to include that fact scenario. And there are situations where that is an appropriate way to, I think about compensating somebody and making them whole. But that particular specific narrow concept of including that into exoneration lends itself, I think, to the gray area. And there are situations where the person, we would believe, is not innocent, or there is, the from a victim perspective, that it would be very hurtful to have it be very easy to say that you are innocent, because from a different perspective, they may not be. And so what we think is, if you think about that concept, where basically, let's say there's a petitioner asks for post-conviction relief, and there's a new trial ordered, the prosecutor then has a number of options. One of which is to retry the case and proceed. And if we have a new trial, a jury is going to make a determination based upon the merits, based upon the reasonable doubt standard. But there's another scenario in which the prosecutor may not proceed. And we do that for a number of reasons, one of which is there may not be enough evidence to proceed. But the other situation is sometimes, from the standpoint of the victim may not want us to proceed because he or she has been through so much. And there are times where we have to consider that. And there are situations that arise very often in that context. And so that's what we're asking you to think about, because if we then have to get into the bifurcated process where we're talking about innocence, then what's happening there is a jury didn't necessarily acquit anybody. Then what's happening there is basically the burden of proof is more likely than not under that scenario. And I think that's just something from a policy perspective that all of you should think about. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk about that. And so I don't know if Karen Long has anything more to add that I may have missed on that point.
Well, Long? Thank you. I'm Karen Long. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. And the only thing that I've pointed out as I've met with the authors on this is that in the current post-conviction statute, there is actually language that in some circumstances requires the petitioner to show actual innocence by clear and convincing evidence. And that's under the circumstance where they're bringing up newly discovered evidence more than 2 years after their conviction was final. So if they're seeking to get around the two-year time limit in post-conviction with newly discovered evidence, that evidence has to demonstrate their innocence by clear and convincing evidence. So for one thing, it's a standard that comes from the language in the currently existing statute. And looking at some law review articles and some other things, we have found that a number of states do require clear and convincing evidence of innocence before compensation, and that includes Iowa and Wisconsin.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was to the last testifier. I don't remember your name. I'm sorry.
Karen Long.
Thank you, Ms. Long. So you stated that there are some states that have clear and convincing. Are there also some states that have just a preponderance?
In the article that I found, there were about four states that had a preponderance standard if they named a standard. And there were about 12 that had clear and convincing if they named a standard. But a couple of the states that had a preponderance standard also required specifically that DNA be used for the exoneration, so it didn't cover other circumstances, which nowadays DNA is less and less likely to exonerate people now, because hopefully we're using it at the front end. And then also there was a state, I think Illinois, that required a governor's pardon with a preponderance standard. So they had some other steps to get up that are different from what we have here.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just out of curiosity, if a state doesn't have standard, it's up to a judge then?
Well, it gets, from these articles that I've read, it gets difficult to compare apples and apples because the statutes or the way that somebody goes about getting compensation can be very different among the different states. So in the other states, I think they just have a different process for how they get there, and they've not named a standard.
Thank you.
Representative Scott. Other questions for the testifiers? Mr. Orpa, did you want to testify?
If I might, Representative Lesch, thanks. I just want to...
Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm Pete Orpa. I'm the Washington County Attorney. I just wanted to echo what my colleague John Choi said, and I want to follow up with what John told the committees, that we've gone to great lengths to not oppose this, but just ask you to consider some of the things that we were interested in, that we would consider a compromise from where the bill started. We did go along clearly with a broad definition of exoneration. We didn't find that offensive.
Mr. Orpitt, I apologize. I'm going to have to stop you right there because I have a bill up. So
yes, sir.
So the conference committee is going in to go into recess. It's going to be all of about 10 minutes, just to keep people a heads up of where I'm going to be at, and then you know where you're at right now.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I also have two bills on the floor. I don't know when they're going to get to them, but they're almost back to back. So when I leave for that, I'll get them both done. They shouldn't be controversial.
Okay,
shouldn't be. I also just want to welcome Mr. Orpitt, but I think he'll find this forum a little less stressful than his other more publicly recent forum.
Thank
I hope
you,
he
sir.
Does anyway.
It's much less stressful. Thank you, sir.
thank you. With that, the conference committee is in recess.